This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Yak! Charlie Morton with the Rays. Harold Baines a Hall of Famer. And looking back at Cody Clemens' season, was it better than we thought it was? Hello again, welcome back to the Extra Bases podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas of orangebloods.com, and winter meetings are, I guess, wrapping up. Baseball, that's the center of the baseball universe right now. Not a whole lot going on the college side of things, but the MLB aspect of free agency and trades and all of that has heated up some over the last couple of days. We'll discuss a lot of those things, including a lot of discussion about Charlie Morton and the Astros. But I want to begin with, for my column this week at orangeboards.com, you know, this is a point in season, this point of the year where football is in that little bit of a lull before the bowl game. Basketball's got a lot of breaks in their schedule right now as, you know, classes are wrapping up and finals are going on, so they're basically only playing a game a week. And baseball is done essentially until January. So I went back and looked, you know, with the year wrapping up, at the 30 best individual player performances by a Texas player during the 2018 calendar year, and I limited it to basketball, baseball, and football. So my pick of, and I'm sure I missed some of them, there were a lot of them. That's one thing that surprised me is how many opportunities of really big-time performances in key situations, or just big-time performances that there were to choose from over the last calendar year. I think that speaks to, this was the most successful sports year that Texas has had in a long time. Probably have to go back to 2009. When you could point to multiple programs having a high level of success. Of course, there's been some programs at one point or another since then that have had bright moments, but I don't think that we've had two perform at quite the level that we had in this over this these last 12 months, with the baseball team going to Omaha, the football team playing in the Sugar Bowl and playing the Big 12 championship game. Basketball is what it is, but it did make an NCAA tournament, kind of against tough odds, especially down the stretch. So it was, I think, the most successful sports year for Texas since 2009. But in doing that exercise of going back and looking at all the individual top performances, I started to marvel again at what Cody Clemens did last year in a Texas uniform. And I think in some ways, even though like from covering that as it happened and discussing it with Texas fans on the orangewoods.com message board as it happened, and you in those situations, we often kind of lean towards hyperbole instead of the other way. But in looking back at what he did statistically, and it wasn't just statistically, it was the consistency that he did it. I almost think that we underrated what he did. And you know, over the next years, and as we look back on at Texas baseball history and, you know, the most storied college baseball program there is, I have a feeling that we're going to grow to appreciate what he did even more. Texas hopes that doesn't happen next year if they struggle offensively, because of just, you know, you can't replace that guy with one guy. It's got to be a total collective deal in replacing Clemens. But I think as time goes on, we'll grow to appreciate even more just what kind of season that was. And in putting together that list of the 30 top individual performances, Clemens was on there more than any Texas athlete. Honestly, he could have been on there a few more times than he was. And looking back, I believe that he was on there 4 or 5 times. And that was a lot of that was some postseason stuff. A lot of that was stuff to end the year, really. When Texas went from a fringe tournament team, I don't know if that's fair, but they were definitely a program that needed to really bolster their resume, as their at-large resume, because they weren't really in the Big 12 contending picture at the time, you know, when Big 12 play was about midway into the season. they didn't really have an at-large resume that suggested being a host at that time. They had played a really tough schedule, but they just hadn't won enough games yet. And then Clemens just basically puts the team on his back. And then there's that moment where Texas had a break in the schedule very late in the Big 12 schedule. And all of a sudden, the pitching staff was just way, way better and more consistent than it was prior to that point. But in looking back at some of these performances that Clemens had, it's just incredible. I don't know if we've ever seen anything like it at Texas, which is saying a lot, considering some of the players that have played at Texas. And of course, you know, I'm 33 years old, so I'm not as well-versed with the 80s Longhorns teams that were winning titles before I was born in some cases. But if you look at the performances on the stage and in the moment, I think you've got to put what Clemens did right up there with any hitter that ever played at Texas, maybe. Maybe. I have to go back and look at some of the seasons and the moments from some of those guys, you know, the Keith Moorlands, Brooks Kieschnick, Spike Owens of the world, and those guys that put up just unbelievable numbers and earned all sorts of accolades and have their names on the stadium somewhere. The Clemens deal, it just was big moment after big moment after big moment after big moment. And I've to see a player like that thrive in those big situations over and over and over again, while you've got you know, postseason coaches discussing, we basically can't pitch to the guy, we've got to pitch around the guy, and he's still hitting the ball out of the yard, which is not a good reflection of the pitching and the execution in certain situations to give him something that he could drive out of the yard. But that was just what kind of zone he was in. It was just every single game you thought that when that guy got up to the plate late in the season, he was going to put a barrel on it and he was going to hit it hard. It was just a matter of, was it going to fall in the yard? Was it going to go over the fence? Or was it going to find a glove? That's almost what it was like, besides the occasional walk or strikeout here or there. But that's the kind of zone he was in. So in looking back at some of the moments I included on this list, number 22 on the list, when he hit two homers at Texas Tech to begin that huge road series in Lubbock. The ball can jump out of Lubbock, especially when the wind is blowing a certain way. But in that first game of that series, a pivotal road series for Texas, Clemens went 4-for-5 with two homers, three RBI, and three runs scored. That Friday night Friday night game win to open the series really allowed Texas to get out of Lubbock with a series win. They ended up winning the rubber match on Sunday. And so much of series are often determined by just how you start, you know, the tone that's set in that first game, because it gives you a bit of a luxury in how you handle your pitching staff moving forward. And it just, you play with less pressure. You know, if Texas goes up there and gets drilled on Friday's game, they're thinking, oh, crap, we got to play two more games in Lubbock. And we just, you know, against a highly rated team, we just got smoked in the first game. But Texas went up there, and thanks to Clemens, put up a big number on the scoreboard and really took it to Tech in that first game and convinced themselves that, hey, you know, we can win this series and get out of here with a huge road series win. And that's what they ended up doing. And the very important thing about that series was, if Texas didn't win that series at Lubbock, it wouldn't have been able to play for a Big 12 championship their next series against TCU. They had an off week for finals, and then they hosted TCU in the final regular season series of the Big 12 schedule before the Big 12 tournament and then postseason and so on. If Texas doesn't win that series, they're not playing for a Big 12 championship against TCU. And also, you got to think, too, if they lose that series and they can't play for a Big 12 championship the next week, because ever since the Big 12 was the Big 12, the regular season champion has hosted a regional in the postseason every single time. Always happens. So winning a regular season title carries a lot of weight when it comes to selection time, because often these teams that win these conferences are good clubs and they have a resume that backs it up. But if Texas doesn't win that series at Texas Tech, it doesn't play for a Big 12 championship the next week or the next series, all of a sudden you're looking at the Texas resume, like, where is its big signature moment? Where is the thing on the resume that sticks out against a top RPI team or on the road that can carry a resume, basically? And while Texas had played a really tough schedule to that point, I'm not sure that there was a big moment on the resume where you could point to and say, okay, there it is. They beat so-and-so, or they swept so-and-so at home, or they went on the road to beat so-and-so. They had a road series win over Oklahoma, who was a solid team, but, you know, it wasn't, I don't believe it was an RPI juggernaut. Last I looked, they had lost a road series at West Virginia prior to that Texas Tech series. So if they drop that Texas Tech series, you're talking about back-to-back road series losses against high RPI teams, basically chances wasted, and then you're hosting TCU at home, who's a solid team, much more talented than their RPI was at the time, but a team that was playing for its postseason lives as well, not the TCU we're used to seeing. So you're kind of looking at, you know, I always talk to Kendall Rogers about this at D1Baseball.com, who's great when it comes to breaking down, you know, how the committee views the selection process and resumes and all those things. And you start to look, and there's not really a signature series win for Texas. They lost 2 out of 3 at LSU. I mean, they opened the year with winning 2 out of 3 against Louisiana, but they lost 3 out of 4 versus Stanford at home. They lost both midweek games at Arkansas. You know, they picked up a couple things here or there. Same Houston State midweek win was big, because Sam Houston State is a top RPI team. They beat Sam Houston State at home, which was a quality one. But otherwise, there wasn't much on the schedule. They lost by a run at Texas A&M. They did sweep Baylor at home, which was a big one. But that's still a home series. That one, I mean, home series wins don't count as much as road series wins. So that was a huge weekend for Texas. And unsurprisingly, Clemens was the one that helped set the tone that Friday game, and really allowed Texas to get a huge road series win and eventually play for a conference championship the next series. The next one on the list for me, I had Clemens's night when he went 4-for-4 at Oklahoma. And that was the second game of that series, and it clinched a road series win for Texas. They didn't get the sweep, but that Saturday win clinched a road series win, which, again, those are huge for the resume. It's not so much, I mean, everybody, a sweep would be nice, but the committee really looks at the series wins type thing, because it's a 3-game set. It's a good representation of who was the better team that series. And Clemens went 4-for-4 that second game against Oklahoma, and he raised his average to that point to 380. 380! He was hitting 380 that late in the season. And that Oklahoma series began on April 13th. So a lot of baseball had been played up to that point, and he was hitting 380 at the end of that game. He went 4-for-4 with a homer, double, 3 runs, and an RBI. And the terrific part about that performance beyond the box score was Oklahoma actually did a good job in trying to attack Clemens in different ways. They used a lefty, they used a righty, they used a weird angle guy. It was the game was in the freezing cold, and he hit everything. He hit everything. It didn't matter who was coming up. Man, my allergies are bugging me. I got the door open because my dog will whine, and he likes to go out and exploring when the weather's like this and go in our backyard, so I don't want him whining beside me while I'm recording a podcast. So you might hear some outdoor sounds and my allergies as well. But it wasn't just that Clemens went 4-for-4 at Oklahoma. It's just the way he did it, you know, hitting lefties, hitting righties, hitting a unique arm angle, hitting in the freezing cold, hitting late-game situations. Just, and there's a moment on that broadcast when you can see when Clemens hits a homer, just the reaction from the dugout. It's just incredible, because this was about the point in time when I think Clemens' teammates could really tell that something special was happening, that he was on his way towards a truly historic type of Texas season. And you got the sense that the players were starting to realize that. And I mean, I'd hope they would. At that point, he was hitting 380. So they could at least look at the statistics and understand that, oh my goodness, this guy is hitting the baseball at a rate that is just unheard of. And yeah, that Saturday game for Clemens raised his average to 380. And it just started this run where he just started hammering the ball over and over and over again. And there was a little bit of a stretch where his average dipped some. But then he picked it right back up, and then one of the signature moments came later in the season. But that was my second inclusion of Clemens on the list, and then we'll find the next one here. Wow, so many great stories from the Texas season last year that I think fans didn't forget about, but just some of the circumstances surrounding some of the performances in the postseason, like when Nolan King was throwing up the morning of his start against A&M in the regional. And he could barely walk around the mound. I had that on the list as well. That was a gutsy performance, especially for a guy that really just started figuring it out again against TCU, the final regular season series. And then we get to the Clemens against TCU, which I think that we'll look back on that moment. If Texas starts to go on the run that I think it's capable of doing under David Pierce and his staff, I don't know if that happens next year because it's such a young roster, but the way the rosters are shaping up for the future and the way this staff has made an impact on the program and the personnel in the first 2 years, it's fair to say that they could go on a run, especially when they get the rosters as loaded as the recruiting lists say they're going to be. When Clemens hit the walk-off homer against TCU, that to me was the moment when Dishwalk Field started to get its magic back again. That place, when it was rocking and rolling, when Augie was winning a ton of games and championships, people, you could see teams just crumble under that atmosphere at times. There was something about Texas would always find a way to win big games at home in front of one of the best college atmospheres there is. And Texas lost a lot of that magic feel to Dishwalk Field because besides the 2014 season, which was a season that Texas fans were totally on the fence about midway through the season. I remember writing about this in my story, my column about Augie Garrido the day he unfortunately passed away. He was asking me in the middle of the season, hey, you think this is a good team? This team's capable of doing some stuff? And I was like, yeah, you guys have played really well. You've had some tough bad break losses against good teams. You guys got a great mix of leadership and pitching and hitting and all those sorts of things. And he basically said, okay, if you write that, you're going to look smart. And I'm thinking, man, he really likes this team. But that team, like Texas fan, you remember they were an at-large team in the Houston Regional. They had to play against Rice and A&M, and they won that regional. So Texas fans were totally on the fence about that team because it was coming on the heels of some really bad seasons. So the Dishwalk Field didn't really have a chance to kind of regain that magic consistently besides when Texas hosted a super regional there in 2014 when Houston came to town and they won. But that season, the way it built up, there wasn't really these expectations about the team until the super regional happened, and Texas didn't even really know it was going to host a super regional until the draw came out after they had won that regional and Houston shocked LSU by winning the LSU regionals. But there was this buildup going on with this Texas team this last year, and a lot of that was because of Clemens. And in the final regular season series, it was back. I mean, the feel in that park was different. It was different in a way that it hadn't been different since probably 2011 when, Texas steamrolled everybody really behind Taylor Youngman and had a really, really good season. But I'll never forget interviewing Clemens after the game and asking him just what he was feeling in that moment or just the emotions, the vibe. And he said that he got chills because the way the crowd reacted to Duke Ellis beating out a two-out infield single to get Clemens in the batter's box, the way the crowd reacted and the energy that it built, you could feel in the park that something special was going to happen. And Clemens even said the same thing. As he said, as he was walking in the batter's box, he got chills because he felt like something was about to happen. And sure enough, he hits a walk-off homer. It was one of the more special moments at Dishwalk Field that I've seen, that I've covered. And I've been around a lot of them. I've basically written about the team since 06 or 05 or 06 and really covered them hardcore for almost a decade. That was one of the moments that I've ever seen. It was the moment where the Texas fan base was they were all in on that team. They were all in again on Texas baseball. They were all in again on David Pierce. They were all in on Cody Clemens. And they were all in on making Dishwalk Field the home advantage that it was for so many years under Augie Garrido. And oh, by the way, it allowed Texas to play for a Big 12 championship the next day. It allowed Texas to win the Big 12 championship by just going out and winning the game. And that moment to me is one we'll look back on over the years as such a special moment because of everything it represented beyond just a walk-off homer. And oh, by the way, it was against a rival, which, noticing a theme, Clemens killed Texas Tech. He killed Oklahoma. He killed TCU. And we'll get to his favorite, I think, moment amongst Texas fans. The moment he had in the postseason. Again, you're listening to the Extra Bases podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com. We're just kind of going back through here some of Cody Clemens' epic performances from last year as I wrote a story or a column yesterday at OrangeBloods.com, just looking back at the top 30 individual player performances at Texas over the 2018 calendar year. Unsurprisingly, a lot of Cody Clemens. And we'll get to the next one, which is... That was number 8 on my list. Number 4 on my list is what Cody Clemens did to the Aggies in the Austin Regional. Oh, man. There's been a lot of moments over the years, especially under Augie Garrido, where Texas would find a way to win games against Texas A&M, and A&M would find a way to lose games. And it was often because Texas would thrive in the big moments, and A&M would not. Well, Cody Clemens, go back to the Austin Regional. The announcement when they were in the clubhouse and we were covering it, and they announced that the Longhorns would be hosting the Austin Regional, and who was in the regional? Indiana and Texas A&M. And it was a pretty subdued reaction because at that point Texas already knew they were hosting a regional. Only one player jumped out of his seat when he saw A&M on the list. It was Cody Clemens. He jumped out of his seat and went nuts while everybody else just kind of sat in their chair and clapped. And I'm thinking, man, this guy really wants to play Texas A&M, and he backed it up because he hit a homer. He hit a first inning homer. It was a dagger. It ruined Texas A&M. Ruined him. You knew with that swing in the bat that the game was over. The game was over. And as he rounded the bases, he put his horns up towards the left field fan tailgate area. And then as he was coming around third, he just stared in the Texas A&M dugout. Stared. He pierced all of those souls in that dugout with just daggers. Like, you guys aren't ready for this. I am. And I just showed you I am. And I'm thinking, oh, man, this guy is in the zone, and this is one of those classic examples of where Texas is going to beat A&M because it's just better in big moments than A&M is on the diamond. And, you know, that three-run bomb and just that stare into the dugout, I mean, it gave Nolan Kingham everything that he needed on the mound, even though he was pitching far less than 100%. And then Clemens again later hit another bomb. He tormented A&M that day, and just on perhaps one of the biggest stages of college baseball for a Texas player, playing A&M in the postseason with so much at stake. I mean, he was at his best. That's a moment that Texas fans will never forget. And then we'll get to the final moment of Clemens, which was, it wasn't necessarily his best box score or his best statistic performance, but Cody Clemens against Tennessee Tech in the Super Regional Final. A winner-take-Omaha game. So pressure's on. And Tennessee Tech had talked about wanting to pitch around Clemens and trying to pitch around him. And Texas is up 2-0 in the third inning. Mateo Bocchi is pitching the game of his life at that point. But Texas knew they can't ride that guy seven innings. They were going to have to use their bullpen at some point. So the runs they could push across and the confidence that they can gain from the batter's box were huge. Well, Texas up 2-0 in the bottom of the third inning, and Clemens hits a solo bomb to put Texas up 3-0. And it's just like, here we go again. This dude is just in this zone where he's putting the team on his back. And to do that in that moment, in that game, again, this wasn't his best statistical performance of the season. Probably, I mean, even though he had a home run, probably middle of the pack performance when you consider some of the games that he had. But to hit a homer in that moment when the game plan from the other team was to pitch around you and you still get something to drive and you still drive it out of the yard that way, and it wasn't even necessarily a great hitter's pitch, it's just incredible. It's just a big-time player thriving in a big-time moment. And I don't think we'll see anything like that in a Texas baseball uniform in a long, long time. When you look back and you just consider the consistently great performances in huge moments that Clemens came through with. It's one thing to have a great statistical season. It's another thing to do it against Texas Tech on the road, TCU at home in a Big 12 championship situation, in the postseason against Texas A&M, in the postseason against Tennessee Tech. There was a point in the postseason where Clemens' OPS was nearly 2,000. 2,000! That's insane! That is absolutely nuts. For any player at any level to ever post a number like that in the postseason is absolutely stupid. It's stupid. I just think that looking back, this exercise just reminded me of how special of a season he had, and also reminded me that over time, we'll probably look back at that season in a way with more appreciation than we are right now or than we did at the time. Because of where it's going to fit historically at Texas and just the amount of big-time moments that Clemens provided for the Longhorns last season. So, yeah, you're listening to the Extra Bases podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com, and going back through the season that Cody Clemens had during the 2018 Texas season. Like I said, you don't replace that guy with one person. It's not going to happen. If Texas can kind of collectively replace him with just the production, that's huge. But you're just not going to get those kind of big game moments over and over and over again from a guy in a Texas uniform next season. That's not a slight to the guys that are back. It's just, we haven't seen in college baseball many seasons like Cody Clemens had in those big moment situations like he did last year. I want to wrap up here with a little discussion about the Astros. The Charlie Morton deal. Tampa Bay Rays made headlines recently at winter meetings by signing Charlie Morton to a 2-year, $30 million deal with a team option for a third year. A team option that's basically based on how many days that Morton spends on the disabled list. Again, this is a guy that's had some injury issues in the past. He's old. But, hey, this was a terrific move for the Rays, who are going to be able to manage his workload because they are so progressive about how they use the opener and things like that. If there are situations where Morton can only pitch 4 or 5 innings, they're not going to stretch him past that. Or maybe he's just a 4-inning, 5-inning starter a lot of the times. But there's still a lot of value in that, especially when you have a bullpen that Tampa Bay has. I think it was a great move for the Rays. I think he's a great fit there because, again, of how progressive they are in using their arms. I'm just really perplexed as why the Astros didn't bring him back on a 2-year deal. And I'm even more perplexed by some of the Astros' fan reaction I'm reading on OrangeBloods.com about the economics of the situation. The Astros just won a World Series 2 years ago. They just played in the American League Championship Series against the Red Sox last season. They're raising ticket prices. They have sold-out crowds all the time. They're bringing in the money. They don't even really have a ton of money on the books for next season. I think the only players that are going to make over $15 million, I think, are Verlander and Gerrit Cole. And I'd have to look back at when Jose Altuve's big money kicks in. But this isn't a small market, penny pitching franchise. I'm a little caught off guard by some of the fan reaction. Oh, you know, you couldn't pay him that much money. Bullshit, you couldn't pay him that much money. 2 years, $30 million? Hey, that is in this era of starting pitching commitments for free agents, 2 years is great. That is no big long-term deal. What's the worst thing that happens? He misses a significant portion of a season? Okay, you take that risk. You're not paying the guy for 6 years. You're paying the guy for just a couple of seasons. That's not really that big of a deal. So I just was caught off guard by, oh, you know, couldn't pay him the economics. The Astros are competing for World Series titles. They're selling out. They've got an owner that's got plenty of money. The biggest misconception in the world oftentimes about sports owners, oh, they just don't have the money to spend. That's complete horseshit. Almost all of them make so much money and are billionaires. They've got the money to spend if they want to spend it. And they're making – these smart business guys don't buy professional teams because they lose money off of them. They buy professional teams because they're good business moves. The Astros are no different. So spare me the idea that the Astros couldn't afford Charlie Morton for 2 years. 2 years and $30 million. Meanwhile, one of the true penny-pinching organizations in Major League Baseball history, the Rays, are the ones that spent the money. The Rays spent that money. The Rays aren't spending that money if it's A, a bad investment, B, if he's not worth it. And see if it was extreme value relative to his market value or his internal value. And the Rays are one of the most progressive teams in sort of in terms of analysis, analytics, determining value, everything in baseball. I'd put them, they're not as extreme as the Astros, but they're as progressive. So if their in-house model is saying, hey, it's okay to spend this money on Charlie Morton, I guarantee you the Astros model was saying the same. And, you know, they go through the same type of medical thing. So I don't think there's something the Astros know about him that the Rays won't know. I just kind of look at the Astros and taking it back a little bit. Like, you guys got this terrific window with all these guys signed under contract. And I know they're moving Colin McHugh back to the rotation, which he was a very solid starting pitcher when he was in the rotation for the Astros. Very solid. But they've got to have some more arms than that. It just, you know, especially if they're going to take it slow with Forrest Whitley, you're looking at the rotation, it's still got some holes in it. And you can never have enough starting pitching. I mean, Lance McCullers is a great example. He's going to be on the shelf for an entire year with Tommy John surgery. So a little surprised the Astros didn't bring back Morton just because he's, you know, everything you read about him as a clubhouse guy and stuff like that. I just don't think that a 2-year deal is that much risk, even with his injury history. Keep him there and maximize what he has left, and then he probably retires, I bet. So I just little confused by what the Astros are doing. But it's December 13th, so the Astros are going to make big moves at some point. I just think that the Morton deal would have been a good fit, especially at 2 years. 2 years, that's really – in this era of baseball, that's not that much of a commitment. And, you know, especially if a team like the Rays is doing it, who historically has not spent – anywhere close to that kind of money in free agency, in a team that uses openers, and they're still valuing a starting pitcher like that. So spare me the idea the Astros couldn't afford Charlie Morton. That to me is just completely silly. Another thing that's completely silly is Harold Baines getting into the Hall of Fame, which, I mean, if guys like Harold Baines are getting into the Hall of Fame through the, again, this wasn't the traditional voting method, so I blast those traditional voters that vote on the guys every year. I blast those guys endlessly because many of them completely suck at what they're doing. A guy like Mike Mussina still not being in the Hall of Fame is complete and utter dumbassery from so many of the voters. But this wasn't these voters voting on Harold Baines. It was guys like Tony La Russa, who got on MLB Network with Mad Dog, whatever his name is, Russo, whatever, the guy that screams a lot, New York-style radio, which I thought was dying, but apparently it's not, and basically said that the conventional way or whatever that – let me see if I can find the direct quote. Jeff Passan had a great quote tweet about it. So Tony La Russa said that the arguments against Harold Baines being in the Hall of Fame are weak-ass, superficial bullshit. He said that on live television, by the way, which Tony La Russa, a little triggered by the Harold Baines discussion. And La Russa's claim as to why Baines should be in the Hall of Fame is His best argument is because of the game-winning RBIs he had. Keep in mind that if you go by Fangraphs' defensive metrics, which I know defensive metrics are far from perfect, but you generally get a good idea of a player's defensive value based on those things. Or you can even just go to Baseball Reference and look at theirs as well. Harold Bane statistically has accumulated, I think it's the sixth or seventh most negative defensive war of all time. All time. Over the course of all seasons, all time. Again, these metrics are far from perfect, but they give you an idea of the caliber of player on defense. All time. We're talking about one of the worst defensive players in the history of baseball. And guess what? He wasn't an elite hitter. He was a good hitter. Sure, he's a good hitter. He hit for a long time. Was he elite? No, not even close. Not even close. His seasons statistically were never really Hall of Fame caliber, ever. They wouldn't be Hall of Fame caliber now. The fact that he's in the Hall of Fame is, and no offense to Harold Baines, he had a great, on its own, heck of a career, man. The fact he's in the Hall of Fame is a joke. It's a complete joke. And meanwhile, you've got guys sitting on a list right now trying to get in, like Mike Mussina and Larry Walker. Larry Walker might not even get in the Hall of Fame. Edgar Martinez. I know Edgar Martinez is a DH, but guess what he wasn't doing? Creating some of the most negative defensive value of all time by playing out in the field. And he was a way better hitter than Harold Baines. Way better. I just can't. I mean, that's classic La Russa. God bless him. He's never going to change. He is who he is. And I guess in some weird way, we can admire that. I stay true to who you are, man. That's cool. That's a good quality in people to have for the most part. But just like he gets on there and says, we got superficial bullshit about the people that are saying Harold Baines shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame when his statistics say that he should have never even sniffed the Hall of Fame. And I love Passan's tweet. He goes, behold, Tony La Russa be clowning himself. That's a new word for our listeners out there, be clowning. I hadn't seen that word before. But if you go look it up, it is a great, great way as like an insult to somebody. But also in the same time, it doesn't read like a huge insult. So behold, Tony La Russa be clowning himself by going on MLB Network and saying that the arguments against Harold Baines being in the Hall of Fame are weak-ass superficial bullshit. And Passan later says, I would gladly have that confrontation debate with someone whose best argument is game-winning RBI. But these are the kind of people that on that committee that vote for guys like that. I'm sure he picked up the phone like, are you serious? Is this a joke? I'm in the Hall of Fame? How the hell did that happen? Well, we'll end it there. You've been listening to the Extra Bases podcast on theact.com. I'm Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com. And before I get on a long Hall of Fame rant, there are a few things I can rant a long time about. It used to be gold gloves, but they've gotten a lot better with those over the years. I think the voters have gotten smarter. Hall of Fame voting, I could go on. And I will go on that rant when the time comes, when all the votes are in and we find out who's going to make that class. I could spend four podcasts blasting those votes, those Hall of Fame votes. It's one of the things I can really rant on. But before I get into one of those, we need to wrap this thing up. I've been rambling on for enough. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed a look back at what Clody Clemens did last season. Even if it might create a little anxiety for Texas fans about how you replaced a guy like that, just know that what he did in putting Texas back on the map as an Omaha team and as a Big 12 championship team, we're going to look back at that as such a pivotal moment in Texas baseball history. We're also going to look back at that season as one of the best ever in Texas history, especially when you look at, and I'm not the biggest, the clutch guy type of deal, but it's impossible to ignore what he did in the biggest moments of the season over and over and over again. So I hope you enjoyed that look back at that. I hope you Astros fans get some news soon. I just got an alert on my phone that Cleveland, Seattle, and Tampa Bay. So the Rays are in a deal again. Cleveland, Seattle, and Tampa Bay made a deal. Looks like, let's see here. Edwin Encarnacion to the Mariners, Carlos Santana to the Indians, and a three-way deal involving the Rays. So I'm guessing the Rays get prospects out of that. Let me check this real quick before I wrap this up. This is kind of breaking news here. So the Mariners are getting Edwin Encarnacion from the Indians in a trade that also includes the Rays. The Indians would get veteran slugger caller Santana. Corner infielder Yandy Diaz and a player to be named are heading from the Indians to the Rays, who will send slugger Jack Bowers back to Cleveland in return. Interesting. I thought they were super high on Bowers. Seattle will receive a compensatory pick as well. So I think that is still developing and taking shape. But another big deal that's going down in the winter meetings. And with that, I'll wrap this up. I hope you all have a great holiday season. Baseball is getting closer. I believe I saw somewhere that college opening day was like 60, 65 days away. Major League Baseball opening day is less than 100 days away. We're getting closer. We're getting through the winter season. I hope this guy's helped you get through your – I hope this podcast helped you guys get through your day. Took your mind off some stressors that can happen at the holiday season. And get to theyak.com/Austin. Check out all our amazing content. Until then, I'll see you next time on the Extra Bases Podcast on theyak.com. Thank you for listening.